علامت البها روحی خانه.
You know, it's so difficult to convey in a few words how wonderful Shoghi Effendi was. And that's why I recommend to the young people that you get this book that is coming out about him and read it and study it. You know, a very strange thing is happening in the world. The people who are highly educated and have the greatest benefits of so-called benefits of our so-called civilization, namely ourselves, are becoming illiterate. They don't like reading anymore, because why should they read when they can look at it on television or in the movies or hear it on the radio? And yet the people outside of these highly civilized areas are so hungry for books. A book, a piece of paper with something written on it, is the most precious thing in the whole world. Perhaps they will be the people who, during the next generation, will appreciate the Baha'i literature. Because in the Indian huts in South America, I have seen many times wholly illiterate families. They have put the news bulletin on the wall of their hut. They have pinned it. It's the most precious thing they have. This was the news from their National Spiritual Assembly, and they have put it up on the wall. Although they can't read a word, and maybe there isn't even a child in the family who can read or write yet. But that is written. There's this thirst to learn how to read and write, and yet we, who have this blessing carried to such a polished degree, are throwing it overboard now. We don't seem to value what we have. And man has spent so many thousands of years of being able to get to the point where you could have a thing written in your hand. It could be yours for you to study and you to assimilate. And now we've got it. The first thing we want to do with it seems to be to throw it away. And I want to talk very seriously to the Baha'i young people about this subject of reading and writing, especially reading the teachings. It is a treasury of life for yourself and life for the whole civilization of the world, for the development of mankind. I sometimes think that one of the reasons that in the Baha'i faith we don't have any priests is because Baha'u'llah has brought, amongst his other blessings, this new development in science. And this has given us the printed word, which was almost unheard of in the past. Some civilizations had writing, but reading and writing was usually the prerogative of the priestly caste. I was surprised to hear when I was in India that many of the kings, the Maharajas and rulers of different parts of India, different states, in the past, not recently, had never been able to write because they considered that this was the job of a scribe. This wasn't the job of a king. The job of a king was to be educated, to conquer, to lead, to stand out as a ruler of his people, and it was a job he often filled very well. But writing was the job of a much more inferior person who was like a secretary. And these scribes have existed all down history where there was writing in the civilization. And the priests were often the only people who could write and read. And because of that, they protected the word of the religion. They taught the people. They had the scripture in their hand. And they fulfilled a tremendously important role in history. And often I said to myself, well, why is it Baha'u'llah has abolished priesthood? And then it seemed to me that one of the reasons is that now we can read for ourselves. We don't have to take anybody else's word for it. We don't need anybody to tell us what Baha'u'llah has said, because we have the bounty of being able to pick it up in our own language and read it and understand it. And we know that no one has the right to interpret it, and that no one has the right to come along and say, well, you don't understand it. I am the one who is appointed to tell you what it means. So that this gift of writing is an immensely precious thing, reading and writing. And I think that you mustn't lose it. The Baha'i youth should think about this. Shoghi Effendi wrote and spoke the most exquisite English. And it has occurred to me, particularly since I came to the United States of America, that we must remember that as he was the authorized interpreter of the teachings of Baha'u'llah, and in that capacity he has given us in detail guidance for implementing, bringing into existence the world order of Baha'u'llah, he has elaborated the administration, he has explained the teachings, he has commented on the different things, the different aspects of the Baha'i teachings, and he's done it in English. Now, this is so important to the Baha'i faith that when the House of Justice wishes to make a decision, some question is referred to it, they have a research department that is working all the time. They are getting a detailed cross-index compilation of the tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá and the letters of Shoghi Effendi. And whenever some question comes up, the first thing they do is to get every single available comment or reference to that that has been made in the teaching, particularly by the Guardian, because he made so many. He explained so many things. In fact, he explained so many things that it is very difficult to conceive of questions affecting the revelation and teaching of Baha'u'llah that Shoghi Effendi has not commented on. Everybody felt when he passed away that, aside from all the personal feeling of loss, the catastrophe of losing this institution of the guardianship, we all had the feeling, well, what are we going to do now when something comes up and we haven't any interpreter? Who is going to tell us what it means? Who is going to tell us what we should do? And it is almost miraculous to see the amount of things that Shoghi Effendi has referred to. They are there in black and white, and they are very, very precious. And we have the opportunity of referring to them, and the House of Justice is constantly referring to them. Now, all this is written down in English. English is a very precise language, aside from being one of the richest languages in the whole world. It is extremely precise, and I'm sorry to say that people are losing, at least in this part of the world, the appreciation of their language. I remember Shoghi Effendi used to say, when I'm not a scholar myself, but when he was writing, he would take words that had the Romance languages, in other words, the Latin roots. And he would take words that had the Germanic root, and he would find that the synonym, because of course there are synonyms in every language, and then he would say, do you see, do you hear the very subtle difference between these two words? Now, this is the word that is proper in this connection. You can't, in the writings of the Guardian, remove a dot from an I without losing some meaning. He is so precise, so exquisite in his use of the English language. And because of the nature of English, and because of the fact that the Guardian had mastered it, and that he was the interpreter of the teachings, Where things were ambiguous in the Arabic or Persian languages, which are the two languages of the revelation of the Baha'i faith, the Bab, Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha wrote in these two languages, Arabic and Persian, and often a mixture of the two. Where the original word is not clear and subject to being either this meaning or that meaning, Shoghi Effendi's translation is unambiguous. So that in going back to the very fountainhead of the revelation, which is the original Arabic and Persian, wherever any of us, and particularly the House of Justice, who is responsible for these things now, can find that thing translated into English, or those words used by the Guardian that occurred this way in Arabic and they are this way in English, they then have an illumination on the original text. So you see, nothing is going to do away with English in the Baha'i faith. We are going to have, till the end of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, which we know will last a minimum of 1,000 years, and there's quite a lot of it still to run, we are going to have our scriptures in Persian and Arabic and in English. Now, that doesn't mean English is going to be the universal language. That's not what I'm saying. Nobody knows what it's going to be. Shoghi Effendi said this was the job of the nations of the world, to choose a language, either an existing one or one that is designed and created by men like Esperanto or one of the others, and is decided upon by the nations of the world to be taught as a secondary language in all the schools of the world. It has nothing to do with the Baha'is. The choice is up to the nations and not to the Baha'is. Neither the House of Justice nor a committee of Baha'is are going to tell this planet which should be their international language, because it must be voted on and accepted by a body like the United Nations. Maybe they'll do it, maybe if they don't, some future body will. But it was something that must be decided, as I say, by a consensus of opinion of representatives of nations. Otherwise, it can never be adopted and enforced. And whatever that language is, we Baha'is will immediately learn it with joy. We can't wait to get a hold of it to learn it. But the fact remains that Persian and Arabic and English are going to be the source material of the Baha'i faith to the end of this dispensation. Now, in view of that, it does seem to me, and it has occurred to me very strongly since I came to the United States, that young people, older people too, obviously, but particularly young people, you're all at the age where you're going to high school, you're going to university. You should bear this in mind, and you had really better get with it as far as English is concerned, because one of these fine days you'll find that what you are speaking is no longer something that resembles what Shoghi Effendi has translated the teachings into and what he has written in. And then what are you going to do? Your faith is embodied in that language for you. And if you no longer know the correct value of a word in your own language as used in the text of your religion, it seems to me you're just as much out of luck as somebody who is a Spanish-speaking Baha'i and is trying in broken English to understand what the Baha'i teachings are about, because he knows that this is the best source if he can read it in the original. What I'm trying to say is, friends, that I doubt very much if a day ever comes when we have to translate Shoghi Effendi into broken English, in other words, back into some language that is developed in the Western Hemisphere, in the northern part of the Western Hemisphere. That would be very sad. So that it seems to me the Baha'is, particularly the Baha'is, you've got so much brains, if you're smart enough to go and do what Dan Jordan said yesterday, go into a career or go into a trade, this requires some degree of intelligence. Well, if you're that smart, you're smart enough to speak your own language and to read the writings in your own language and understand what they mean. I thought that I was, at least in English, quite a well-educated person. And when Shoghi Effendi began to send these great letters to the Baha'i world, particularly to the Baha'is of the United States and Canada, which was the strongest point in the Western world, I had to refer to the dictionary many times to understand what he meant. But then this opened my mind. This was my education. Through reading the teachings, you not only read the writings in the original, but you get the most marvelous educated vocabulary. When I was a little girl, there was a Baha'i in New York. Her name was Carrie Marsh. I'm glad to mention it in front of so many other Baha'is. She was a little tiny thing. She was very, very strong. She was as strong as a man. And I was very afraid of her because she loved me very much. And she always hugged me so tight that I could feel my ribs crack. And she was a very humble woman. Her profession was carrying around a little box in which she sold notions, needles and thread and things like that. And she used to peddle it in the big shops where the sales girls had so little chance to get out and make any purchases. And this is the way she earned her living. Now, you know, Carrie was so passionately addicted to the Baha'i faith. She loved the teaching so deeply that she had a vocabulary that you could have sat her down next to a Harvard professor. He would have had hard going to speak better English than Carrie Marsh. And there it is, a whole free education in one of the most beautiful languages in the world, right in our own writing, right at hand for us to absorb and to enjoy. I'd like to tell you something very adorable about Shoghi Effendi. Any of you who have studied his writings knows that he sometimes used very long sentences. And I can remember when he was writing God Passes By, as I remember now, I think that this paragraph was 2.5 pages long. So I looked at him. Of course, I certainly hoped that I was never impolite to the guardian. And I looked at him reproachfully and I said, Shoghi Effendi, you know, that is a rather long paragraph. It's 2.5 pages long. He looked at me if he weren't the guardian of the faith, I'd say sheepishly. And and he didn't answer, but it's quite clear he got the point, but he didn't change it either. It's still there. He used to just play with the beauty of English. And sometimes he would write, as you remember probably, very, very short sentences. And it'd just be 5 or 6 words and then a period, and another few words and then a period, and a period. He said, You see the punch that this has? You see how different that this is from the long sentences? Listen to it. And he would call my attention to it. He enjoyed it. He loved English. Really, you could say that he was in love with the English language. And I don't think that people realize that Shoghi Effendi wrote every single thing out loud. Very interesting. All of this is in this biography of The Guardian that's coming out. You can read it all there. But the Bab, you remember, when he began to write the Qayyum al-Asma on the night of his revelation to Mullah Hussein of his station, he was intoning these verses, in other words, chanting them, because Persian and Arabic can be chanted. English can't be chanted, but it can be spoken out loud. And I thought, well, that was something, you know, confined to the Bab. It never occurred to me that anybody would ever dream of doing this in English. And the Guardian had a strange custom. He liked to have someone in the room when he was writing, either in Persian or in English. He always had someone in the room long before I was married. One of his secretaries, if it was Persian, a member of his family, And this was his custom, and he always wrote it out loud. He said it and he wrote it. So I had the great bounty of hearing him compose out loud, because he wanted me to be in the room when he was writing, everything that he wrote or translated after I was married, and including that marvelous book, God Passes By. And his approach to it, the cadence of the words, if you read it out loud, this is really a trick about Shoghi Effendi's writings, even such heavy going as those big paragraphs in God Passes By. If you know English and you understand the punctuation and how to read it, and you read this thing out loud, it is even more beautiful than when you read it silently to yourself, because it was written out loud. It doesn't seem possible that anything that is as tightly woven together and as heavy going, because there's no doubt about it, Shoghi Effendi's writings are heavy going. It's like eating the very quintessence of beef steak, you know. There's nothing that you can afford to lose. Every bit of it is nourishing. And as you read it out loud, you see the words and the value of the words. You hear the words and the value of the words even better than when you read it silently to yourself. And try it sometime. It's also a very wonderful way of learning English diction. If you will read out loud and listen to your own voice and the way you are emphasizing and breaking the sentences, you will find that you enjoy English much better, and you speak it very much better. Another strange thing about The Guardian when he used to write was that I can't remember his ever giving up. He would try and compose a sentence. Unfortunately, I have a very bad memory, and I never can think of examples when I want them, and I never know where anything is in the teachings, and I never know what page it is on, and so on. But anyway, the point is that he used to say the forcefulness of his character, the beauty of his face, the curliness of his hair, you know, whatever it was. He'd build up a sentence this way, then he'd come to one that you just can't do that way in English. You have to invert it, it doesn't come out right. Well, he wouldn't give up. And I've seen him struggle a half an hour, three quarters of an hour, with a long sentence where this could not be done in English. Now, I was sitting there. I was supposedly to be of some use. I can cite four things that I suggested to him in 20 years. Four words. But nevertheless, I sat there. And I say, well, Shoghi Effendi, why don't you invert it, because that way you can get that one in too. You see, you just turn the whole thing around, all of them, and then that will come out right. That I don't wonder, it doesn't sound nice. Listen to it. This sounds beautiful. Now that one, I've got to get it in there. And he would get it in. I never quite understood how, but it was really like somebody that was wrestling with something. He wouldn't give up. He would go on and on and around and around and around and around until somehow or other, like I always said, like mosaic work. He would get this little tiny piece of mosaic stuffed into that pattern where he wanted it. And then he would go on to the next thing. He had this infinite, infinite capacity for work. I think that people must realize that although Shoghi Effendi was the sign of God on earth, the descendant of the manifestation of God and of Abdu'l-Bahá, nevertheless, aside from all of that spiritual power and heritage and divine guidance and everything else, I have often thought that he was a genius in his own right. And I think one of the definitions of genius is a person who has the capacity for a tremendous amount of persevering work. You know, in science, in art, in music, in literature, if you study those people that get to the very top and are outstanding, so often it has been done by a very, very simple process of just hard work. They didn't work 3 or 4 hours and then lie down and have a ginger beer and look at the television. They went right straight on, 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, 16 hours. And it is that kind of work That means that at the end of his life, a man has accomplished a great deal. Now, Shoghi Effendi was that kind of a worker. I have never in my life seen anybody with the power of work and concentration that the Guardian had. And it was really an example to all of us. He just kept at it until he did it. He drove through until he had succeeded. Whatever it was, didn't matter what the nature of the thing was. Whether it was having a wall built or having the side of the mountain demolished and carted away, or something that he was writing, or something he was going to write, and he was doing a tremendous amount of reading and making notes. He did it all the slow, thorough way. And that's why you have so much that he has accomplished, and it's of such high caliber in every single field. I know when he wrote God Passes By, he sat down for a year and he read every single thing. And of course he had an exhaustive library of Baha'i books and things. He read all the tablets that had been sent into the archives. He read all, and he made copious notes throughout the years, the important excerpts and things that he had come across. He had taken out in his own handwriting and made excerpts. This was the source material for these marvelous quotations. And he read all of these things and everything Baha'u'llah had written, and the commentators on the faith had written, the non-Baha'is had written, the Baha'is had written, the enemies had written, because he was the guardian and he had a right to study all of this material. He knew that it couldn't do him any harm or poison his mind. And he had gone over all of this for a year, and then he kept constantly making notes and excerpts. You see how far that was from lazy man's way. He didn't click a tape recorder and say, on page 13 of such and such a thing, there may be something I want to refer to, click and turn it off again. He just then and there quietly sat down, copied it all off in his own handwriting, and made sure he hadn't made any mistakes. And this was building up his reference material, his source material, and then he would go on to other things. Then when the time came, up after about a year, he began to write the book. He just would sit down and he would compose by the hour. As I say, he liked to have someone in the room, so I was almost invariably in the room with him. And he would write and write and write and write and write. Then he would make a clean copy often of what he had written in his handwriting. And it was so interesting. Shoghi Effendi, you know, was small. And that's often a very great comfort to small people. You know, not everybody happens to be the size of the Americans. And some of the people of this world are just little tiny people. The American Indians, many of the tribes, are tiny, tiny little people. Even on me, they come up to here, the men. And when I tell them that, you know, Baha'u'llah was very small in stature, and Abdu'l-Bahá was a little taller, and Shoghi Effendi was like Baha'u'llah, very much like him physically, and very small in stature, it's a great comfort to them, because bigger and better, you know, seems to be one of our ideas in this world. And it gives lots of people an inferiority complex. They really think that there's something the matter with them if they're small, and they feel badly about it. So I'm so glad that the manifestation of God was small, because it encourages other people. Well, anyway, Shoghi Effendi always wrote on a little piece of paper, pads of this size. He had pads that size. Never a big piece of paper. I don't know why. He liked it. He was very, very meticulous and concise and precise, and he had these little pads, and all of his manuscripts are written on that. Now, this thing that I'm writing on is small for me because I go like this, you know, from one side to the other. Nobody can read my handwriting. And he was just the opposite, tidy and neat and concise. And as I say, he would often make another copy, a clean copy. Well, when he had finished writing God Passes By, which took him, as I remember, about a year, took him 2 years for the whole book, and he was under great pressure because he wanted to have it published for the centenary of the Declaration of the Bab, 1944. Then he sat down and he typed the whole thing himself. And, of course, then he could put those little finishing touches on the manuscript as he typed. And one of the things that he did when he typed, he had, I think, only two. Maybe sometimes when he got very active, he had four fingers in use. But usually it was just two fingers, and it was a little tiny portable typewriter that big. And he typed his whole manuscript on that. He had, an original and five copies, because we had to have enough copies so that we could mail them out, and they would, if anything was lost during the war — this was in the middle of the war, after all, very difficult period to get things to reach their destination. And therefore he had a number of copies. And then when all this was done, we would sit at night, beginning after dinner around, 8 o'clock, and go on perhaps till 12 or 1 o'clock. He would have three copies, and I would have three copies to correct and to put the accents on. And he would say, dot under the H, accent on the first A, accent on the last I, and so on. And he would read this out loud, correcting three copies, and I would sit beside him and correct the other three. And we'd do it until we were blurry with fatigue. He'd do it till his eyes were red and bloodshot, and he was absolutely exhausted. But then we got God Passes By in the hands of the Baha'is in 1944. When you read this book, which I hope that you will read, about the Guardian, you will see that along with his wonderful feeling for English and his command of English, he had something else, which is the mastery of a language. Now, supposing you were — I'm not a musician, but there are many people in this audience that are very musical, obviously, and musicians — supposing you were going to play something, and you were restricted only to one key, there was only one single way that you could ever play, refer to in a melody, it would be rather sad. It's the fact that you have a number of ways of producing it, a number of keys in which you can get the melody out, that makes for variation and beauty. Now, the same thing exists in English. There's more than one way of saying something. And if you refer to the Guardian's writings, you will find that he had many ways of saying that a person had become a Baha'i. And I plead with you, for God's sake, stop saying "declared" all the time, like a bell bang, "declared." He declared, I declared, she declared, we declared, they declared. They are going to declare. We've had six declarations, three declarations, four declarations. I don't know. It's ghastly. It's simply ghastly. It's ghastly English in the first place. And in the second place, it really hasn't got much meaning. If you go back to the paragraph in which Shoghi Effendi said that, you will find that it's embedded in a whole paragraph, and it's something to the effect that those who have declared their faith in Baha'u'llah on this, that, and the other thing. Now, at some period in our modern world that worships the cliché, where everything has to have either an abbreviation tagged onto it, or a sign, or a slogan, or something, that's neither good living, good thinking, nor good English. And it doesn't have to be that way in the Baha'i faith. Shoghi Effendi said, those who have enrolled under the banner of Baha'u'llah. He said, converts to the Baha'i faith, a good old missionary term. These are all in writing, thank God. You don't have to take it from me. You can go look it up. He said, those who have embraced the faith of Baha'u'llah, those who have accepted his revelation, those who have become Baha'is. He used many, many terms. I can't say exactly how many, but I venture to say if somebody wants to do a research project on it, they'd find that he used about 10 at least, all meaning the same thing: he became a Baha'i. So don't let us always restrict ourselves to one word. And it sounds so funny in front of non-Baha'is. You must remember that we're trying to attract humanity, not repel it. And you speak in front of educated people, university students, young people with their modern attitudes towards society, older people that are embedded in the church like rocks or something, and they hear this pat phrase come out, declared, 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 and they wonder what on earth we're talking about. And I think that I only pass this on to you. I feel it very, very strongly, obviously. I wouldn't be so vehement on the subject. But it's bad English and it's not necessary. The other thing is, Baha'u'llah nowhere in his writings mentions signing your declaration card, signing your card. Now, that doesn't mean that people don't have to register. But we must, I believe, get it clear in our minds and get it clear in the minds of the people that we are teaching that you do not accept God and the supreme manifestation of God by signing a piece of paper. It's not a pledge. You become a Baha'i in your heart. Or, alternatively, if your heart isn't very active, you become a Baha'i in your intellect. But there comes a point where you accept Baha'u'llah. You believe that he has come with a message and a system for this age which should be accepted and which is the hope of the world. Now, you can put it in thousands of fancy phrases, but that's really what it amounts to. That is becoming a Baha'i. You build on that and you go on from that. Everybody has to be registered, because otherwise how could they have their rights as Baha'is? I know in many primitive places where we're teaching the cause, we don't present it to the people in a clear way. Many people in countries where they are illiterate, they don't want to sign anything, and in some places they won't give their name. Why? Because they think you're enlisting them in the army. They think it's the poll tax. They think that if they give their name, they're captivated by you. Somehow or other, you're going to get a grip on them, the way the government has got a grip on them, by taking a census, and then they get a tax paper. And they won't give their name, and they're afraid. And then you have to explain to them that the reason that we want their name, and the reason we want them to be registered, recorded, there are many different ways of doing it. In India, they hand in 2,000 names, a list that a teacher has made of 2,000 new Baha'is. Usually they have the thumbprint by the side of it, so there's some way of finding out who on earth they were, at least some proof that this person existed, or it's an X, and then the teacher is written in the name. But the point is not that. The point is that when the person becomes a Baha'i, they must understand that they are receiving great privileges. That's why you're registered. You can get your national newsletter, if there is one. You can be elected on national bodies and appointed on committees, local, national, whatnot. You're a man, you can be on the House of Justice. If you're not registered as a Baha'i, if you don't belong to this organization of the Baha'i faith, which is the vehicle for the teachings and spirit of Baha'u'llah, then what good can you do? It's all flimsy and nebulous, and it has no power of cohesion, no power of force to execute things, to carry them out.